integrity of history has been under attack amid the worldwide war on truth and the ruinous prevalence of disinformation. In the Philippines, as we experience the Marcos administration today, historical distortion has only grown as readers struggle to fact-check everything they read and fall victim to falsified information. As the prominence of historical distortion grows, the credibility of our university historians has been under attack. As we continue to defend the credibility and truth of history, the main responsibility falls upon publishers of school books, books that serve as the very foundation of one's beliefs about our country's history. Publishers like them make way for stories and studies to reach audiences that radically shape public understanding. Today, we will be talking to Ms. Karina Bolasco, director of the Ateneo University Press, as we delve into the reintroduction of martial law literature and the dangers of historical distortion amid the worldwide war on truth. We answer the question, how can the stories of society from 50 years ago inform the history and memory of society today? I'm Rome Sainz. Let's go on point. Thank you so much for joining us today, Ma'am Karina. I wouldn't have as much of an idea of my own culture if it weren't for the Filipino books that I had to read for school.
Good for you. Yeah, by your time, we had many local books already. You know, that was 26 years of producing local books. And within that, because in the beginning, it was dominated by publishing in English, but eventually we moved to Filipino because with Bob Ong, I don't know if you know Bob Ong, he started to build a readership in Filipino other than the romances, because before that, it was all just the paperback romances that were widely read in Filipino. But with Bob Ong, many young people moved to reading in Filipino. Even students from Ateneo started to read Bob Ong. And because they were in National Bookstore, had so many outlets, we were able to kind of popularize all of this. We had Jessica Safra's line, we had Ambeth Ocampo. We started all these series at that time. By 2016, there was new management. I kind of thought that maybe I should move on to something else. And that's when I came to the University Press.
How would you describe your work then and now?
Well, the work at Anvil was more, of course, very interesting because it was a wide range of topics. We could do anything. No? Because you were producing for the stores and you had to parallel more or less the genres that the American books have, you know? So we were doing everything, self-help, literature, everything, autobiographies, thematic anthologies. But with the University Press, it's a bit more, because it's here, we're looking at pioneering works, researches, or studies that make an impact on the on previous studies, no? So, or they can either make us look at things in a new way. You know, for example, we always thought that our rice terraces were 3,000 years old. And then you have a new study by Stephen Acabado, an anthropologist, who says it's only 500 years old. There's proof to say that, no? So that's actually what a scholar is, no? A scholar chooses a topic that nobody else is interested in usually, and then devotes his life or her life to studying the topic, and then eventually, so makes an impact. And in the field, in that field of study, but eventually could be displaced by a new research, a new scholar who finds new things. So our goal is to do that, because that's part of the university mission, you know, to contribute to nation building by doing and publishing such books that we hope will be read and applied or derived or adapted into other things by people who can, so that they change or affect policies, for example, whether policy, whether public or private, programs that NGOs are doing, could, if they benefit from a study, could, you know, shift their, change their goals, modify their positions. So this is our goal. So these are very specialized studies. They're not for everyone. Some people will find it difficult to read them. But we're hoping that there will be people who will transform them into other things that are more popular and can, you know, impact or affect a larger audience. This is what we're hoping our books would do. We don't want them rotting on shelves. We want them read, and we're hoping also, and little by little, I see this, that many of the young staffers of senators or congressmen are reading these books, and slowly, maybe, they will make an impact on the laws they make, the policies they support, you know? Even if the politicians themselves don't read it, but if you know, if you have staffers who are researchers who are looking at these books, we hope this will make some kind of impact on what they think should be legislated for to improve the quality of life of people, of Filipinos, no, in this country.
It's very fascinating for me to see how something that originates from my university can, you know, impact the yeah. whole community and different areas of society. That's very mm-hmm. fascinating for me. I think it also kind of has to do with a list of reading material and on martial law and the previous Marcos regime, dispelling the implications laid out by today's dilemma with historical revisionism. So what were your intentions on releasing this list?
Okay. Actually, in 2016, former President Duterte was already considering the burial of Marcos in the Libingan ng mga Bayani. The family of Primitivo Mijares, the author of the expose Conjugal Dictatorship, came to us and said that they were actually annotating it for a young audience. That means, you know, it was a 1976 book that came out in maybe 220 pages. When it was brought to us, it became 600 plus pages because they had to put in a lot of end footnotes to explain to a younger generation who the people are in the expose, what places are these, what events is he referring to. But the expose itself, written by Mijares, who was the right-hand man and confidant of Marcos at the time, when he went to the States, he turned and then testified in the U.S. Congress and then wrote this expose. We didn't do anything with it because it's the account of a dead man, no? So, and there were so many stories around what happened to his family after he wrote this expose. So when that came to us, we felt it was important to put it out just to remind people, if the people have forgotten, if people had forgotten in 2017 when Marcos was buried in the Libingan ng mga Bayani, what it was like. I mean, we know that there were many stories during martial law, but there was also this story. It's one of the stories of martial law. And so, and martial law was declared, and martial law was real. I mean, there's so much documentation to show that. We had to put it out, so we did. And that was 2017, when the pandemic struck, and we resumed selling, meaning books had to be ordered online, but it was still physical books that were being delivered. By June of 2020, so many things happened. ABS-CBN was shut down. Maria Ressa was sued, was convicted. There were many things happening. And so this book just became, it's our fastest selling book right now. We've probably sold over 20,000 copies. And then followed Some Are Smarter Than Others, Again, a new edition of something that already came out in the 1990s, rigorously researched about how the cronies of Marcos acquired their wealth, no, by just being powerfully connected to him. And we kind of put it out by the time Duterte said that the Lopezes of who owned ABS-CBN were oligarchs, and his what he was doing was to take down all these oligarchs. It was exactly the same line of Marcos at the time. Take down, that's why they confiscated ABS-CBN and all the other businesses, because the Jacinto Steel, everything, because these were the oligarchs and they had to be taken down. So we put out the Summer Smarter to show that eventually he had his own new cronies. While the oligarchs were taken down, there are other people now becoming the new oligarchs or whatever you call them. So because even with the former president, he was beginning to have a new group of businessmen who were privileged because of their connection to him. We put it out around that time and launched it in 2020 together with the Ateneo School of Government. And we had that. And, you know, it was so much easier, became easier to promote. It was much easier to engage a public in social media at a time of lockdown, because everybody was just on social media. They couldn't go anywhere else. There was no, so everybody's there. So it's a more contained venue. By June 2020, we had a new young marketing head who was very tech savvy. So we became more visible on social media. Even they would be able to create their own slogan, so to speak, or spins, you know, something like on June 12, history books are on sale, but not our history, you know, things like that. People wanted to understand more what was happening. And I think in the noise on social media also, books became more authoritative, as in you have to go to a book and see for yourself what's really proven and substantiated by research, by evidence, by studies. And that's why books are very important. I would like to say that we're not just doing this for politics or for history, but even in other areas, no? We're also producing books for the arts, for sciences, and other fields for the same reason. We'd like to be able to generate debates, a real discussion over issues, so that we get to a point where we agree on what's good for Filipinos, no? For all Filipinos, not just some Filipinos. So we try to do that in all the fields, and we look out for studies for the political situation. Ateneo Press has several titles in its backlist, also on martial law, no? Because of course, after EDSA, it's not true what they say that nobody wrote or researched or studied the implications of martial law. There was a lot, but these are academic and scholarly studies. And unless they were, you know, unless you had teachers putting them in textbooks, they would not go down, no, to a wider audience.
If I cannot share also, the first thing that I did after Bongbong Marcos was elected president was I got my copy of Conjugal Dictator.
Okay.
It was the first thing on my bucket list so that I could also understand the context behind the previous Marcos regime. Mm-hmm. So in that notebook, these books that were listed were written in a context different from what we experience in our current society.
Yep.
Why is it important that these materials are being read today?
Because there is a real attempt to, because suddenly although we knew how the elections would turn out because there were surveys, and these were surveys that have traditionally been proven right, but because of the, you know, the pink rallies, we were hoping there would be a miracle of some sort, but we knew also at the back of our heads that it's really going to take a miracle. It will have to be God's intervention, no? So because they had been doing this, actually Marcos, the old man, knows his stuff. He's a myth maker from the very beginning. His life alone, huh? At a young age, after graduating or while studying law, he murdered someone and defended himself single-handedly. You know, there's so many stories. He marries an illegitimate daughter who used to live in the garage of the Imelda Marcos. There's books on her, the untold story of Imelda Marcos, who walked, you know, barefoot from her house to school, and maybe that explains her preoccupation with her obsession with shoes. You know, and it was a 11-day courtship or something, very quick, and they got married. So it was really very annoying. Parang pang telenovela talaga, parang pang soap opera, diba? So it's he knew that, and during martial law, when the Department of Education was making the textbooks themselves for the entire public school system, they came out as, you know, malakas and maganda. And in the myth of creation that is being taught to children, when the bamboo splits, they will see Ferdinand and Imelda. No? So talagang the myth-making has been there. And that was why it's easy to also restore, you know, rehabilitate their name after EDSA. And so when you see all of this, you have to learn new ways of fighting it, no? It's not just every time you see a troll saying this, you confront it, you know, that we have to find new ways of doing this. But the books will have to be there to be the basis for the references for what has been proven, what has been substantiated by evidence and long years of study. So, but we hope that the way this will be used will be fresh, creative ways of, you know, by young people, not just reacting to troll commentary, but to do new positive things on the, and yeah, maybe flood social media with these things, but not because you're answering, but we create a new narrative that could fight this narrative, or, you know, we'll have a chance to stand up against this narrative, which is funded also, and where they hire the best people and they can have a troll center. I mean, like a call center, but you have trolls, you know, but which we are not able to do. The way that it became organic during the campaign of Lenny, or the pink, I hope we could do that. That, you know, it also becomes organic, creatively. And young people doing this in all fields of art and culture. And not necessarily just wait for to see a troll comment and answer it and explain, you know, very lengthy explanations that they're not going to read anyway, because they're really just told to mouth certain things or say certain things, you know? So I hope that I was thinking we should have some kind of art forces of the Philippines instead of the, you know, that the young people will organize themselves and when they do their orientation, and then they're left on to them on their own to create and to imagine.
As a communications major, definitely new media and different ways of like watching plays, watching movies, mm-hmm. on different topics about martial law. I think those were the ones that really impacted me mm. as a student.
Yeah.
Like seeing yung mga Dekada Setenta.
Exactly, yeah. Mm.
The Kingmaker. Mm-hmm. The Kingmaker is a newer version of all of those. So on that note, what role do you think the Ateneo University Press plays in an era of disinformation and historical distortion?
Put out books that will help us navigate not just the coming 6 years, but we've been doing this for so long. So going as planned, we already have a lineup of books for this year. This is also our 50th year. It coincides with the 50 years of martial law because the press was, I am told, was organized in 1972. Even if before that, there were many units publishing. It was only 1972 when it was organized as a press. Yeah.
To also hear a bit more about our history of the Ateneo University Press na sobrang sakto for yeah. the anniversary of martial law. Is there any particular theme of the books that you're going to be releasing?
We've already launched our logo for the anniversary year, and we're using Narrating the Nation. That's our theme, no? Because we really have the press, and this is not, I mean, this was from way before when it started with Mrs. Esther Pacheco, who was the founder, and I mean, who was there when it started and really built up the line of Ateneo. We're reissuing 12 classics. When we say classics, these are foundational texts when they came out. They were interventional texts when they came out, meaning they made an impact on the field of study or in the field in that particular discipline, and then became foundational texts, meaning if you're studying history, you cannot, or if you're studying a specific, for example, pre-colonial, revolutionary period, there are books that you have to read. So they're foundational texts before you can move on to other books. So we're reissuing 12 of those classics. It was hard to decide which 12, but we have an editorial board composed of faculty from the different schools in Ateneo, and we decided on the 12, and they will be reissued with, in new covers, with new covers.
Sounds very exciting for me. On another note, what do you think students can do to play a part in the fight against historical distortion?
Students should keep reading because this is a phase in your life when you're really required to read and study. So we hope you really look at and read. I know some are very difficult to read, but there are also works. We also produce literature. We've done novels also and poetry and lighter essays. But there are also books that are inspired by, you know, our foundational texts or, you know, by our classics. And if they're easier to read, and then use those as your parang nakasandal ka sa pader, di ba? It's something that you have solid backing because this has been rigorously researched and studied. And share, maybe if there's, I don't know if there are outreach programs that you do so that you can also pass this on. If there are organizations that you are in, and maybe think of projects that will be more responsive to the times. Even if they're business courses, there are always ways of merging things together. No, I mean, just have to be creative. Like, even if you're just doing shirts, t-shirts, right? I mean, the quotes you put on the shirts, you can get something from a big book, and if there's something that strikes you, you can use it, or maybe translate it to Filipino or to what other, you know, a more accessible language to millennials, then you can do that, right? There are many things that I hope young people really will do, because as we saw, maybe the pink movement didn't have enough time, it was too late. But the way organically, you know, just how many songs were composed, how many, you things like that that you can do as students, as young people. There's no limit.
Very insightful as always. Apart from what you've mentioned about public service and the pink movement, what do you think the general public naman can do to fight against historical distortion?
We have to be maybe more tolerant and listen to each other's stories, because maybe some of the 31 million didn't really have their stories, but were maybe paid or have other interests. But they're also, I'm sure, a good number of them who really had experienced things differently during martial law. And that's also one story. And that's also true, right? I mean, they didn't have, you know, during martial law, like me, I was about to get to college in 1972 and I wanted to go to UP, and my parents didn't want me to go because it was the hotbed of activism. So I chose St. Scholastica's College, and I got the same thing anyway. They didn't know, but it was also the dean at the time when I got in was already Sister Mary John. So the activist during martial law was kind of the black sheep of the family. Everybody worried about the activist. Parents were crying over activists who were over their children who were so committed, and the parents were not seeing anything. They would always say, "It's not even wartime. What are you doing? Why are you doing this?" You know, they were considered. So not all families had activists. Not all families had children who became, who were tortured and detained. Not all. So they probably just really went through martial law, thinking, you know, these buildings were being built. The cultural center was up. The heart center was up, the lung center was up. So it's also their story, but they also have to know of other stories. But this cultural event of Made in Malacanang versus Katips is that starts this, this in this administration, should be a good point of departure to discuss how we will navigate the next 6 years. But also to be more critical, to be more, not be accepting of things as givens, as if we're all powerless and we just think this is how it should be, this is how life is.
I definitely agree, po. Once you go online, everyone's arguing for their part of the story without listening out for much others. And you also see that people aren't so critical anymore of the information that they see online, since this information is so prominent. So yes, it's very important notes that you brought up. So that note, thank you so much, Ma'am Karina, for your time. And we hope that the Ateneo Press and historians continue to be honored even in spite of today's circumstances.
That's all for this episode of On Point, the guidance podcast arm where we sit down and talk with experts on issues in and beyond Loyola. Special thanks to our executive producers, Hannah Mantos and Iana Luis Padilla, as well as our producers, Mina Mata, Joaquim Esmelo, Enrique B. Halidi, and Alyssa Evangelista. This episode was edited by Hannah Mantos. Our cover art is by Jazzyrae B. Maglente, and our theme music is brought to you by Vivid Productions. This has been Rome Science. Thank you for going on point with us.